Today on the Emerging Cricket Podcast, Nick sits down with fellow contributor and author Tim Brooks to talk about his upcoming book, The Batmaker of Copenhagen. The wartime novel is based on a true story about the Gestapo's pursuit of a man trying to source materials across Denmark to make cricket bats and to ensure the game continues to run. Nick and Tim also discuss issues in the emerging game with a focus on Europe. As always, make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you are listening and to follow us across the social medias. And as always, you can find us at emergingcricket.com. Enjoy.
Well, now we're back to welcoming an old friend of emerging cricket, author Tim Brooks, who's recently published a new book on cricket in Denmark during World War II, which I'm certainly very interested to hear about. First of all, welcome, Tim. How's it going?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Yeah, good to see you.
Now, the book is called The Batmaker of Copenhagen, The Story of Cricket's Second World War Hero. It comes out on the 1st of April, so if anyone's looking for that, it's available very soon. Give us a little plot summary, because that's certainly an intriguing little setup there.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's an interesting one because I came across the story on which this is based while researching cricket on the continent, which was my first solo book. And it was a brief reference, actually, to a guy in Denmark during World War II under Nazi occupation, when cricket was threatened with stopping altogether because they couldn't get replacement bats and balls from England. And he kind of took it upon himself to try and make bats himself in Denmark without really much of an idea of how to do it, and under considerable risk involved, because the Gestapo were kind of tracking movements of everyone. There were curfews in place, and also the Nazis had, you know, commandeered factories and things for which to build anything. So it was a very kind of high risk venture, and I was very struck by just the depth of his passion for the sport in a country which is not, you know, by most people identified with cricket. So that was the kind of germ of the idea, to sort of expand that a bit more and make it into a novel, albeit one that is based on a true story.
So is this like an espionage thriller, or more of a sort of a whimsical view of the game, or some kind of blend of the two?
I would say, I mean, at its heart, it is about the quest of one man to protect what he holds most dear to him. And then kind of around that, I have wrapped a kind of espionage story based on the resistance attempts to kind of get their country back, I suppose. And the novel starts in 1943, and that's quite an interesting period in the war in Denmark, because the resistance has started to sort of gain confidence and had been launching a lot of sabotage attacks on kind of Nazi infrastructure, and obviously there were then kind of retaliation, so it was starting to escalate. In the initial stages of the war, you know, the Danish government had stayed in place, and it was a kind of a different situation to other countries like the Netherlands or Poland, where the Nazis had taken direct control. But by 1943, the situation was a little bit different, and that is the context for the story kind of going ahead from there.
Yeah, and I mean, just on that, with the way that the Danish government was kind of in this semi-puppet state to the Nazi powers, the interplay with the resistance. The Danish king at the time was, I mean, he was still in Denmark, whereas, for example, Wilhelmina in the Netherlands had fled into exile with a lot of the resistance. So the Danish king at the time, was seen as a bit of a symbol of resistance in his own way. He regularly rode down the streets on his horse, gathering crowds. And so, yeah, that in itself is kind of an interesting story that you're referring to there, in the way that the resistance was starting to build by the mid-40s, 43 as well, the first year of publication of Information Information, a well-known Danish newspaper that's still going today, and it's very proud of its history as a Nazi opposition paper. So, yeah, a very interesting time in Danish history, and sort of threading cricket through that. I'm very interested to read the book and to find out how that all goes. Does the king make an appearance in the book? I would be, it's just, I guess, for Australian listeners with an Australian Queen of Denmark now, maybe it's on the top of my mind.
He doesn't. Generally speaking, at the kind of core is it, at the core of the story is a kind of duel between the Batmaker and the Gestapo chief. And the Gestapo chief is kind of intrigued. He doesn't quite know what's going on, but he sees this man kind of going out across Denmark, including to some of the remote islands, where he's trying to find Willow, actually, for the bats. But the Gestapo chief kind of gets it into his mind that he's some kind of resistance supremo who's pulling the strings behind the scenes. And then there's an element of the book where the British, who by 1943 are trying to support the resistance through provision of weapons, but also, you know, sort of strategic advice, kind of latch onto this as, you know, a potential Achilles heel for the Gestapo chief, because he becomes slightly obsessed with the Batmaker. And so you've got that kind of duel at the heart of the story. But you've also got, you know, the process of someone, you know, learning how to make a bat, going out and finding the materials, and, you know, under considerable risk, then going ahead and making something. So there's something around the kind of crafting of the bat as almost a kind of spiritual journey for this person, as he tries to, you know, protect cricket in Denmark. And then, so you've got that quite personal story, and then beyond that you've got that broader context of kind of resistance and counter-resistance, and, you know, the British trying to encourage the resistance to challenge from within, if you like. So there's kind of, it works on kind of several different levels.
Well, that little sort of vignette of, you know, a guy trying to figure out how to make bats is, it you know, makes me think of, I guess, in the real world and how cricket is growing in, say, Brazil, or even talking to people in Mali about, you know, bats is a huge obstacle for a lot of, you know, emerging cricket nations, because, yeah, you do need willow if you want to pursue it at a certain level. But the Brazilian administration and Mali, I certainly know, sort of making their own bats, obviously not out of willow, but out of local materials, and sort of doing their best to keep the game going, using what they have on the ground. And it's kind of an example of the innovation and you know, the, as you refer to in the book, you know, the love of the game that just inspires people to go to wild lengths to keep playing this silly and wonderful sport.
Yeah, and I think without giving too much away, he doesn't get it right immediately. he has a couple of wrong turns as he tries to go through this process, because he's doing it sort of relatively blind, although he has a little bit of help along the way. And it's an interesting one, because I think, you know, it is a character study to some extent of this guy. He's a cricket scorer, a former player, but a scorer. And he's quite kind of quiet and unassuming. And a lot of people in Denmark at that point were trying to kind of lay low and kind of, you know, get through the war, if you like, without drawing attention to themselves, because, you know, the Gestapo were organising, you know, roadblocks and various other things that were impinging on people's freedom. So he was trying to kind of get through, you know, the war unscathed, if you like, which almost kind of emphasizes the strength of his passion for cricket, the fact that he actually took on something that was very risky, and where, you know, if he had got caught, he would have almost certainly been sent to a camp. So, you know, the stakes were very, very high, but that shows his kind of love for the game, I suppose. And I think for readers who, you know, don't know a lot about the history of cricket, you know, on the continent, they might be a little bit surprised just how long cricket had been played in Denmark, and how, although it wasn't a huge community, it was a very well established cricket community by the 1940s, you know, and there was a lot to lose. I think, you know, the cricket community kind of saw cricket as a bit of a refuge, in amongst the kind of chaos of occupation, and that's partly why I think, you know, he was inspired to this kind of heroic act.
Well, and I guess sort of winding the clock back on, well, cricket in Denmark, and, you know, we can look across to the Netherlands, even Germany, where cricket was definitely played, you know, well back into the 1800s. Cricket in continental Europe was, it wasn't really the product of empire in the same way as, for example, Australia or India. It was the product of a kind of an enthusiasm for, you know, Anglophile kind of attitude towards, you know, this weird foreign game. And you know, you think of guys like Karl Postuma in the Netherlands, who was, I mean, definitely one of their best players of all time. He played a decent amount of first-class cricket over in the UK. And, you know, I think Denmark was a pretty similar situation in terms of the game being sort of a fancy of, you know, probably richer communities. But it wasn't kind of imposed on the country. It was adopted naturally. And, you know, then moving from that to the English seeing the game as a way of fighting the Nazis is kind of an interesting turn for the sport.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the origin of cricket in Denmark, it's kind of two roots, really. So one of them is that Denmark had an industrial, you know, revolution starting a bit later than it did in England, but you know, from the kind of 1850s. Part of that was expanding the railway network, and there were English engineers that went over and took cricket with them, and some local clubs kind of started up as a result of them introducing it through building the railways. But actually the main route was kind of richer Danes, I guess, going to public school in England and then bringing the game back from there. And it was very much, and this was similar in the Netherlands, actually, very much around the values of the game, the kind of the moral aspects to it. And that was very much part of why they were bringing it over and why they were promoting it. So the first matches were in 1866. So, you know, we're talking really early here in terms of global development of the sport. And there was actually a kind of pamphlet produced, which was circulated through the Ministry of Culture about, you know, the kind of moral backbone and values that cricket could instill amongst, you know, people who played it, including, you know, physical prowess, mental prowess, the tactical side of the game. Again, quite a few parallels with that, with the case in the Netherlands. Interestingly, though, in Denmark, one of the reasons why it did catch on a bit was that there was a previous game played in Denmark called Langbold, which was kind of a bit like rounders, I suppose, but it had elements of hitting a ball and similar elements to it. And I think what they kind of did is use that and say, look, cricket is a bit like that. It's exciting, but it's also got the kind of strategy element to it. And it's also got the, you know, manners and Englishness layered on top of it. And I think that helped cricket get a foothold in Denmark, where it maybe didn't in certain other parts of Europe.
Well, and I mean, you know, you talk about the railways and the English engineers. That's a similar story to, say, Brazil and Argentina, where, you know, there was a strong cricketing community around that time, and you know, well into the sort of first half of the 20th century, Argentina was a very solid cricketing nation through a lot of the similar kind of connections. And, you know, even in Italy, you know, early football clubs were originally sort of cricket and football clubs. So there's a lot of the same kind of trends in terms of spreading the game. I'm interested in what your research kind of dug up on Germany, because, you know, Nazi Germany, there's some amusing anecdotes, I guess, of, you know, you read quotes of Hitler thinking that the sport was insufficiently violent, and he thought pads were unmanly, and, you know, some kind of weird things like that. And there's actually an interesting book by a guy called Dan Waddell called Field of Shadows, about a tour by a sort of a gentleman of Worcestershire in the 30s as well, which I think was kind of a propaganda sort of thing, similar to the 36 Olympics. So there was definitely some kind of, I don't know if interest is the right word, but the Nazis were aware of cricket and they were kind of looking at it with suspicious eyes. So I'm interested in what you kind of dug up on the game in Germany around that time.
Yeah, so I read Field of Shadows, thought that was really, really good. And, you know, there was a very vibrant cricket scene, particularly in Berlin. Actually, there were quite a few kind of cross-border games in the northern German states, Schleswig and Holstein, and in the southern bit of Jutland as well. So there was a history of that already by the 1940s. Interesting what you say about kind of suspicion of the game. So one of the reasons why the Gestapo chief, you know, gets this kind of obsession with the bat maker is because, you know, obviously he associates cricket with kind of Englishness, and that's obviously the enemy. And I think, although he doesn't have evidence necessarily, I think he suspects that, you know, that might be a natural kind of conduit through to the special operations executive, kind of forerunner of MI6, which was operating and supporting resistance networks. So that's partly why, although they didn't ban the game, there was certainly more interest played maybe in cricket clubs than other kind of, you know, social units, I suppose. So that probably flows a bit through from what you said around what was happening in Germany. And actually, one of the really sad things about Field of Shadows is it's quite clear that, you know, in the 20s, there was enough interest in German cricket for it to, you know, expand. And part of the history of cricket in Europe is how it kind of rebounded after the war and where it rebounded. And it was, I think it's fair to say, it probably did, you know, stop some progress that was happening, some of which kind of wasn't really recovered for another few decades, really.
Mm. And I mean, you can kind of make the case that in some ways it never really recovered until the sort of wave of cricket-loving immigration arrived in Europe and revived the scene in a lot of places. I guess an interesting point of comparison is a really nice article by Rod Lyle on the Emerging Cricket website, talking about Dutch cricket and the spirit of 1940, and how the Dutch cricketing community during the occupation, you know, sort of did everything they could to keep the game going and you know, changed the rules of the competitions and allowed matches to go on, and if they didn't have fields and all this sort of stuff, how they pretty much were forced to adapt to, you know, really, really terrible circumstances, and you know, just the love of the game keeping them going. And I guess it was the same thing in Denmark and other places.
Yeah, I was just saying that I actually bring in Dutch cricket a little bit into the book because he has a friend who is a scorer in a Dutch club, and they kind of correspond. So I try and bring in that broader context a little bit into the book. I mean, one of the things they had in the Netherlands...
Is the friend's name Rod?
No, but he could have been, I suppose. but I think one of the things they had in the Netherlands is they had some of the grounds were kind of commandeered because they were worried about them being used as landing strips for kind of covert operations with the British. So that was another aspect which was quite interesting. I didn't come across that happening in Denmark, but as I say, there was that kind of broader suspicion. I think one of the interesting elements about both Danish Dutch cricket in its origins is that, and this possibly isn't, you know, appreciated by kind of broader sports fans, but, you know, cricket had, you know, a structure much earlier than football did. And actually, you know, it was being played, as we've said, in Germany, Denmark, Netherlands, but also Italy is quite a good example as well. And actually, there was a period of about 15 years where, you know, cricket was being played before football was, where it had a chance to become, you know, a kind of primary sport in those countries. But what I found when I, you know, researched cricket on the continent, my earlier book, was that actually the people that were playing it didn't want it to spread that much. They wanted to kind of keep it exclusive. And I think I said in Cricket on the Continent that, you know, that was one of cricket's missed opportunities. The 1880s and the 1890s was a missed opportunity where people tried to keep it to themselves, keep it exclusive, rather than really try and spread it. And by the time you got to kind of 1900, 1910, you know, football fever had really spread across, you know, a lot of the globe.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would make the case that a similar attitude is still kind of afflicting cricket in a lot of ways around the world, even today. So it's kind of the formative experience, and we still need to shake it off. I guess looking a little bit sort of beyond the war and you know, occupation, as you know, liberation came to Europe and you know, the cricketing communities. Obviously, the Netherlands still has a passionate cricketing base these days. Germany, it definitely declined a lot, and Denmark is kind of interesting in that the base of cricket remained. You know, you think guys like Ole Mortensen playing in county cricket, even Amjad Khan, who played a test match for England. You know, Danish cricket has persevered, and now it's kind of the families of immigrants from cricket-loving nations that are keeping the game going primarily. In the Netherlands, it's a similar story. So I'm interested in, you know, how that kind of story continued after the war and sort of where the overlap was and I guess the decline and rebirth of cricket in Europe.
Yeah, so it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, the ICC only brought associate status in the mid-60s, you know, and Denmark had been playing cricket for 100 years by then. So it's definitely a missed opportunity because of the, you know, the imperial mission, if you like, of the originators. And Rod's actually working on a book, which we'll talk about this in a bit more detail at the moment. But yeah, so, I mean, you know, that's a bit of a crime, isn't it, really, that you know, 100 years went by without a kind of structured international program. I mean, if you look at both the Netherlands and Denmark, what they really wanted was MCC tours, because they wanted to keep that connection with the rulemakers and with England. There was also, obviously, you know, matches between different countries as well, including, you know, Scotland and Ireland, for example. But by the time, you know, Denmark got associate status, and then you went into ICC trophies and things like that, you know, and they were one of the leading teams, you know, in the early decades of the ICC trophy. And actually, you know, access to BBC, cricket on the BBC was definitely a big factor in the Netherlands, and a little bit so in Denmark. And then, you know, for a while they did play in English county competitions in one day. I think that only ended in 2005. And then, as you say, there were a few, you know, trailblazers that went over and played county cricket. You know, most recently, maybe, you know, Freddie Clocker, you know, played some games, had a first class, a couple of first class centuries as well. But I think what you found actually is that there was a bit of a peak in the mid 80s where the player numbers were pretty high. But if you think about it, you know, since the 80s, football has really commercialized beyond imagination and has really kind of squeezed out other sports. And I think rugby has faced a similar challenge as well. And therefore it kind of started to dip, I think, from that peak in the mid 80s. And then it kind of started to rise again as you say, South Asian immigration coming into those countries and giving it a real boost again. And that has meant that it's, you know, the composition of cricket is, you know, different in Europe than it was, say, 30 years ago. But actually, if you look at Scandinavia, it's one of the fastest growing sports in Scandinavia. And Scandinavia is one of the fastest growing regions for cricket, actually. And I think we will start to see, you know, those teams doing well. You know, Germany, you know, very narrowly missed out on the Challenge League playoffs, for instance. The player numbers have exploded across the region, you know, and there's quite a lot of money put in by the government as well. So I think there's a lot of potential in the region, actually. Probably hasn't quite been fulfilled yet, but I think the next decade will be quite an exciting one to follow for the Nordic countries.
Yeah, I mean, I know from, you know, watching the Danish team at a couple of competitions, there's certainly a lot of talent coming through the Danish system. And that's a testament to the fact that these people who just love the game so much have kept it, you know, kept it going over some pretty tough times. And, you know, I guess highlighting the themes in the Batmaker of Copenhagen, that, you know, the love of the game, you know, that the people have and that we all have for this sport. And it's really inspiring. I guess I want to look a little bit more broadly into cricketing fiction generally. I mean, there's not that many novels about the sport, you know, published every year. I know certainly some kids books growing up in Australia, there were some some good kids' books that I enjoyed reading. And one of my favorite books of all time, actually, is a cricket book. It's called Chinaman by Shehan Karunatilaka. It's about Sri Lankan cricket, and it really captures sort of the the energy and the chaos of cricket in Sri Lanka in the 90s. It's a great read. I'm wondering if you have any kind of favorite cricket books or any insights into the cricket fiction world that you'd like to discuss.
Well, I've got Chinaman actually on my bookshelf. I haven't read it yet, so I will definitely try and get that up the list, if you like. There was also a novel recently, wasn't there? The Test, I think it was called, which came out, I think, a couple of years ago. But there's not been many. I mean, in India, there is a kind of subgenre of kind of romantic fiction with a cricket context. I remember I went to a talk on that at the Oxford Literary Festival once. It's kind of Mills and Boone, but with a cricket context. Oh, so that was quite interesting. But I think one of the...
I don't know what to make of that.
I don't know. I haven't read any, but it is a genre. I think one of the interesting things about cricket is that, and I guess people would make this argument about other sports, but I think there is something unique about cricket in the... just the level of devotion and passion that it inspires, and particularly Test cricket, but maybe slightly less so 2020. And so that, you know, that lends itself to drama, I think. But one of the, I think, challenges for me, you know, going from kind of, you know, non-fiction book to a fiction book, albeit based on a true story, was trying to get the kind of balance right between demonstrating the kind of deep passion that cricket inspires, but without making it kind of appear kind of trite, if you like. So, you know, that was quite a challenge in the book. And I think that might be one of the reasons why, well, put it this way, I think it's quite brave to write a cricket novel. I certainly had quite a few moments in writing it where I was, you know, challenging myself on whether, you know, I'd got that kind of balance right. But I think there's definitely a lot of raw material there. And obviously the link to kind of Englishness, the link to class as well, is a massive factor in, you know, the development of cricket across the world. And you know, those two themes lend themselves quite well to fiction generally. So perhaps, you know, more people will start to look at this as an area. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you might know. I don't know how many novels have been written about football. For instance, I mean, I'm assuming more, but maybe or even rugby. You know, I don't know what the general level of books, novels is on that. But I would say, you know, having just written one, there are probably easier novels to write. But this was a story that I thought deserved, you know, to be told, because, you know, the heroism of this guy was extraordinary, really. And it's always nice to shine a spotlight on that kind of thing.
Yeah, lots to think about on that front. I think also we're talking about the Netherlands and Rod Lyle. I think back to Rod Lyle recommending the book Netherland about a Dutchman who takes up cricket in New York.
Very, very good, isn't it? Very good.
Yeah. I'm glad he told me to read that. So that's another good example if people are looking for cricket novels, although the kind of cricket is sort of a more of a backdrop than the topic of the novel, but it's certainly an interesting book and a great read. So a lot of books to look into, some good recommendations. The book, of course, comes out on the 1st of April, as discussed. It's coming out through Pitch Publishers. It's called The Batmaker of Copenhagen by Tim Brooks. Thanks for joining us, Tim.
Thanks very much. Always a pleasure.